Hi there, and welcome to our podcast, Mindfulness at Work. I'm Cara Pollard.
And I'm Beth Miles.
Eve, thank you so much for being here with us and for agreeing to come and talk to Beth and I. So welcome, Beth, to Mindfulness at Work, the podcast. We have Eve Rodsky here. And Eve, I just want to say thank you. Honestly, every page I turned, I felt this
picture of that.
It's Cara's overly post-it noted.
They're gorgeous. Where did you get that colors? That type of pink post-it. That's,
you know, I have an 18-year-old who's a senior, so those are her post-its, and I borrowed them. But I have to say, every page, I just kept saying thank you to you in my mind, like, how does she know this? How did she think of this? Why didn't anyone else validate me on this? And to be fair, I've been married for 28 years, so close to 30 years. And I have a 25-year-old, a 22-year-old as of yesterday, and an 18-year-old. And I have to say, my husband is, I would label him as better than most, with a moon rising over traditional. And so I don't even know how to say that that equates, because it's true. But I mean, every page, I just felt like gratitude to you for seeing all the work that we as women do. So I just wanted to ask you, you know, what was your why? I know the story, but why don't you give us the story about the list and the spreadsheet, but also why you wanted to do this for every woman? Because I think that's what you ultimately did.
Well, thank you. You're going to make me cry and take my false eyelashes off, which I just learned to put on myself during COVID. I will tell you a tip to your listeners. It's actually not hard to put on false eyelashes, and I learned how to do it this week. And I'm tearing up, and I appreciate you saying so much. I think for me, it was a combination of curiosity, and also Beth and I just talked about our mutual love of Stuyvesant Town, where I grew up. But what I don't really get to talk about and explore a lot in the book is sort of where I came from growing up. And where I came from growing up was a single mom household. And my father left us when my mother was pregnant with my brother. I was three. We lived in Virginia. We relocated to Avenue C and 14th Street. My mother didn't get alimony. She traded it for acrimony, right? That's that balance, as a lot of women do. She didn't want to fight over that. And so we got what we could get, but she was really existing on this social worker salary, trying to get tenure. And it was hard. It was hard. And I watched her struggle a lot. And I think, you know, I think a therapist would call me a parental child, but starting around seven, I would help her with eviction notices and these utility bills. I would say to her, mom, you know, if you see a red notice on the utility bill, like, you have to pay it this week because they're going to shut off, you know, whatever. And it sort of became this cycle of being her partner in helping raise my brother, flagging for her that he had a developmental disability that no one saw, you know, all the stuff that maybe a child shouldn't have to do. And so I think that's how I became obsessed with systems and organizational management. And on top of it, I had vowed, Karen, that this wouldn't happen to me, right? That I wouldn't be my mother. And so I actively sought out a more than most, or who I thought was a more than most, man. And things felt really fair in the beginning of our relationship. You know, he would stay up all night quizzing me in my dream job. I got my dream job in philanthropy at JP Morgan. I'm a lawyer by trade. So I would mark up and give him free legal advice and mark up all his operating agreements. And he gave me credit for his growing business. And we would take turns ordering in, getting the quarters for our laundry, you know, downstairs. And then, you know, cut to two kids later. Mm-hmm. And my entire life had been upended. Every single stereotype that I vowed I wasn't going to fall into, I fell into. And as you know, from what I wrote about in Fair Play, that all came to a head on this day that Seth sent me a text. You know, I'm surprised you didn't get blueberries. And, you know, it just was this culmination of like, fuck, you know, if my marriage is going to end, like, I really wanted it to be over my affair with an NFL player. Right. Like, in Michigan, I dated a lot of athletes. Some dramatic affair in the Caribbean. Like, that was like my sexy 20s life. Yeah. You
know, a hunky moment.
My husband owns nightclubs, like really sexy. And it was just this cliche that I was like, I'm out of here. Over like off season fruit.
Right.
Yeah. It just was like, and then I was crying also because I was thinking existentially, I used to be able to manage employee teams and I can't manage a grocery list. I'm thinking to myself, what, you know, I have a diaper bag and a breast pump in the passenger seat of my car. I just opted out of JP Morgan and into my own firm to become a case of the 1099 because I couldn't do it all. And I value my husband's job over mine. I had a pen that was stabbing me in the vagina as I was trying to mark up the contract, racing to take him back from his toddler transition program. You know, it was just like, you know, it was just like an existential moment, sort of probably how a lot of women are feeling right now, actually, during COVID. Yes. Of where am I? Like, who am I? Right. And how did this happen to me? And, you know, it came crashing down that having it all doesn't mean doing it all. And maybe my crash just happened 8 years before a lot of women's crashes. But I think a lot of women are feeling that way today.
Yes.
And I want to validate.
I think maybe the difference too, Eve, is your crash happened and then you look to solve the crash. I think a lot of women do crash. And yet you took your crash a step further and said, what could I do to solve this crash? Which I think is really, I mean, the whole pivotal point of what Fair Play and what your journey has been.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I called it like, I wanted to find divorce for married people. All my friends who were thriving were women who were divorced. And they said like, oh my God, it's the first time my husband ever did laundry for our kids. He has to take them to school now. I have all these weekends off with all this unencumbered mind time. They were thriving their careers. But obviously I had a very traumatic experience being a product of divorce.
Yeah.
And so I kept thinking like, there has to be some middle ground, right? There has to be a divorce for married people. And what I knew was that my day job is a very interesting one that very few people have. It's a niche practice. I'm called a philanthropic advisor, a family business advisor. But what I do is like, if you think about those HBO Succession type people, right? That show, you know, I work with those types of clients. I work with very high net worth patriarchs and matriarchs, and I work with their, you know, 2, 3, 4 generations of their family to bring domestic harmony based on a shared system.
Oh, interesting.
And values and a different, and it's what I call this values-based mediation and expectations, a combination with organizational management. And I kept thinking, if I could get this crazy man to like, you know, communicate in an effective way over the most complex organizational decisions, like why should the same practice and principles work for the home? But yeah, I assumed someone had done it first. So my first step in the journey was just to read every single article and book that had ever been written on the gender division of labor. Beth, back to like why I wanted to solve it. I thought it was already solved out there somewhere.
Right.
And I think that was the sad part to me, because what I realized is when I would type in organization and women and home, what I realized is we had been sidetracked as women into this conversation about the life-changing magic of organizing our junk drawer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a real life-changing magic in long-term thinking for women. How do we want to plan our life? Where do we want to be? Not be surprised about all the things that are disadvantageous to us when we decide to have families. And, you know, so I think it was so dry as hell, all the stuff out there. So I realized probably no one read it because it's dry as hell, not fun to read. There's no storytelling. And on top of that, we're sort of talking about organization in terms of our junk drawers and not our long-term planning.
Right.
That was sort of the assessment of the field, I think, when I was starting to write.
I think that's what really struck me in this whole process of what you've done is that it's like you backed up. And maybe you did, you came from in your family, you were more mindful than most about what your partner would look like because you saw what your mom had gone through. But I was struck by this idea that you seek a partner as mindfully as you seek your graduate work, right? Like you're really thinking, what do I want this life to look like? And I wonder how many women actually have that thought, right? And how do you, to your, like that long-term thinking, how do we lay out, how do we believe these stories that came forth, you know, for us? Like this can really happen to you. You can be sitting in the blueberry text message about to lose it to even the strongest of women. Like we need to believe that this can happen, see it in ourselves and get in front of it. I think that's what's so beautiful about what you are putting forward. And how do you really help women to just plan, right? It is a planning.
That's it. I'm not advocating for 50-50. I have a very different view of gender justice. I don't really give a shit what your fair looks like, as long as it feels fair to you. Right. And so I think that was the difference in how I look at things, because it was the same thing I tell my clients. What's equal is not fair, and what's fair is not equal. Mm-hmm. I can't say to you, you're all going to get the same inheritance, because son number one has been building the family business, and now he included data storage cloud servers 10 years ago. And so he made $3 billion for the family. Like that has to be accommodated for, right? These are the conversations I'm having with other siblings of my clients, right? What fair is not always equal, and what equal is not always fair. And Beth, what you just said is so profound, because we all think it's not going to happen to us. And fundamentally, I think that that is patriarchy, even though I don't talk about it that way. I try to be more light and fun so women aren't scared of my message. But I think the patriarchy really benefits from when we think these are private life issues as opposed to public troubles, right? Public issues. And I will just change one word in Beth, what you said. You said that women need to believe that it can happen to them. I'm just going to change one word and say it will happen to them. It will happen to them. I interviewed 500. And so that's what I really wanted to do. I wanted to be very serious and thoughtful. My mother is a professor of social work, and so her PhD is in sociology. My background is economics and anthropology, but also law. I wanted to treat this like an academic project, so that I wasn't just some random life coach being like, this is how you live your life, right? So, but I had to write it interesting, right? So that was like the hard balance of, I wanted to be read in one day, but I really wanted you to understand that there is a 12-page bibliography for a reason, because I honor the women before me. I'm not the first person to talk about emotional labor, the second shift, the mental load, invisible work. We've been talking about these things since Virginia Woolf said a woman can be Shakespeare because of her unencumbered mind. But I really believe in giving that credit where the credit is due. And just to say that I wanted to be a voice to say that, like you said, to warn people behind us. And also for the women who are in the peak of their careers, that taking agency in your own life is actually a very feminist act. And those are the two things, to say we're not alone and that you can be a game changer in your own marriage. I think that's really what I wanted to add to the conversation.
Yeah, and I think you did it as though you were a professor. Like I felt like it was done in such a structured way that my mind could easily read this book and easily understand the message that you were giving. And I just felt so, you know, I said that validated, but I also could understand it so easily through your stories and the research. So I think that the way you laid it out was just, you know, remarkable. Although I think that your message is that maybe because it's shrouded behind closed doors, that there hasn't been a cultural belief shift. The policy hasn't changed as much as it should have. And so I believe maybe that's why you did it for everyone, so that we could start to have these conversations that would affect change.
Absolutely. You're cultural warriors, Karen Beth, right? I mean, the fact that, thank you for having me on. I mean, thank you for helping me spread this message. I mean, I don't think anything other than a global pandemic could have been, you know, I mean, that is the best way to spread this message. That's the silver lining for all the suffering that we're going to do. There's no better way to make invisible visible and to show that so many of us, I love this one Google engineer who reached out to me recently and said, what I realized from reading this, it was a man who said that he's a Google engineer and that he had been ignoring in the work-life equation life. And he said, like any other time when I would program, if I ignored a huge variable in my equation when I was coding, my system would crash.
Right.
So I love that analogy, right? Because he's like, I think that life variable actually has to be into the equation. Mm-hmm. And for men, for so long, they've been able to ignore that variable and just be the ideal worker. And it doesn't benefit them. So many men have said to me, and that's why Fair Play became a love letter to men. They said, like, the societal norms of what I'm supposed to be, the breadwinner and not to cry and be vulnerable and not to let my kids, my sons play with dolls, like, that doesn't benefit me either. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, not pitting men against women, but to say we're all in this together, and it's really going to require all of us, men and women, especially in hetero cisgender dynamics, because that's really where the gender division of labor starts. Right. It trickles over to same-sex couples, and I could talk about that. But I think starting with us all realizing that none of this values us. So that was always my question when I asked men. I would go into these interviews with men. Like I said, I had over 500 of them, besides all the articles and books and surveys and binders. I mean, I can show you my binders. I have binders and binders of articles. And I brought them into my each meeting when I was trying to sell the book, you know, with my backpack and three binders. I'm like, this is just this year what has been out of this will work. But I think what I would ask a lot of men, especially professional men, is I would say, do you believe an hour holding your child's hand at the pediatrician's office is just as valuable to society as an hour in the boardroom? And sadly, in the professional class, actually in the working class, there was a lot more yes. Mm. In the professional class, right, a lot of men of power who set our policies for employment, I'd say most of them said no. Mm-hmm. Wow. They don't believe that statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't see the value in it. Mm-hmm.
I think that that's from what Beth and I have done. We have found that I have coached so many men who I have so much empathy for. They don't know better. Nobody ever taught them. So I think your message, if you can get it across to men who are making the policy, who are making the decisions, if you pose them a question like, which is more important, and they have to contemplate it, then they can make a change. But before this, they haven't known nobody's posed that question to them. And so I think it's really important that you pose that question. And I mean, they at least now can contemplate the answer, and it isn't a slam dunk in the boardroom. You know, I mean, you said, Eve, that it's just as important because you're taking your child to the doctor, and we know it now in spades for society, right? Because they're sick and you don't want them to get other people sick or, you know, go to school sick. So.
Exactly. And I have some beautiful, I wish I have it here. I have this beautiful note that this one man sent me. Of his child, he did take his child to the doctor, and he sent me a note after saying, look at what I got for my kid. And it was this beautiful note that said, dear dad, I'm so happy you took me to the doctor, you know, all like written in.
Right.
And it really made me feel better when you hold my hand. Like, it couldn't have been more apropos.
Right. Right.
And I think, oh, here it is. I actually have it here.
You have it.
This little note.
Aww.
I love you so much because you take care of me and Sam. And when we go to the doctor, you hold our hand. I love you so much more than you know.
And he'll remember that.
What is more important than that, right? Especially in this COVID crisis, are we finally getting that existential push to say, you know, do we want, what is a midlife crisis? Do we need breast implants or a green Ferrari? Or is it really about actually living, you know, being interested in our own lives and recognizing that we're multidimensional and adding the life back into the work-life equation.
I mean, we know COVID-19 is bringing so many things to the forefront. And I was just listening to the, and excuse me, because I forget his name, but the former Surgeon General who was under Obama, he's lovely and he's been interviewed a ton. And he was talking about the real, you know, we know smoking is dangerous. We know all of these things, these decisions we make in life are dangerous, but human connection seems to be the thing that we are lacking most right now. And when we pay attention to these points of connection, that is when people, we're seeing it, like, so much so with COVID-19, the sense of isolation. But prior to that, already there was this acknowledgement that isolation and detachment was really harmful to us. And so if you bring that into a family environment, right, and someone spent their whole life in that boardroom not connecting, that there's a different type of isolation that happens. And even in the work Cara and I have done in acknowledging that when men have a chance to be more attached, like your letter shows, they are more successful when they are successful in the home. They bring a level of success and confidence to the workplace, and they feed off of one another.
And empathy. Connect with different people. I think, like, that's the beauty. Can I tell you a story that's on the book? Just a story that I love about this man. And he's very important right now because he keeps being promoted. He's an essential worker in that he's like the head of a major bank in the U.S. But he's an early fair play person, but sort of, Cara, like what you were saying, an interesting mix. He's the kind of guy who said to me, yeah, I support my wife, but, you know, she's the CEO of the home and I'm a CEO outside the home. Like, throw up, you know, like, well, I don't know what that is, Ed. But so he says this to me, and this was 2018, at the end of 20, I had interviewed them for Fair Play. You know, I got them through, you know, I just interviewed everybody I could find through probably a colleague in my old bank. Even though he's not the same bank as I was at. But so we were talking, and his family understood the concepts of fair play, right? The concepts of fair play are super easy. They're just organizational management in the home, which is like, own your shit. You know, in the workplace, we own our shit. Apple calls it the directly responsible individual. Netflix calls it the rare responsible person, where you don't wait to be told what to do. You know, and I call it conception, planning, and execution in fair play, right? You hold a fair play card. Meals weekend. That doesn't mean you say, well, what are we eating today? I'll cook it. You plan the menu, you get the groceries, you get it to the table, right? That's owning your shit. So it's not a hard concept to understand. So I was interviewing this couple. His wife comes to me, calls me back up after we had interviewed them, and her mother had just entered the hospital for a neurodegenerative disease. She was the main caretaker, part-time worker. It was the holidays. She was completely overwhelmed. Again, sort of similar to how we're all feeling now. Just, I can't do this all, and I need to implement fair play. And I was like, well, your emotion is high and your cognition is low. Probably not the best time.
Not the good time.
But tell me, Julie, like, what do you need? So she basically says that, you know, she's, you know, planning travel for the holidays. She's taking the ornaments out. She's taking the kids to school. She's trying to finish her end of year deadlines for her part-time job. All these things. And basically, now that her mom's in the hospital, she's breaking. So I said, well, what, you know, give me a low-hanging fruit. Like, what's triggering you today? So basically, she said it was her second son, Brody's, second grade Secret Santa project. So say that five times fast. Second grade Secret Santa project. It had to be done from scratch. Thank you, schools, right? So basically I said, well, like, that's one card, right? That's the homework card. Like, hand it over to Ed. You understand what therapy is about. And she gave me 100 reasons why she couldn't. Ed will forget. His time is more valuable than mine. It won't get done on time. You know, it'll be a sock puppet, you know, just okay. So instead of like communicating that to Ed, like, let's back into what fair play is really all about, which is your why. So values-based mediation doesn't start with using these cards or any list, right? Because then it just doesn't work. Lists don't work. Lists alone don't work, right? We've been making lists for 100 years. So how do you enter someone into a system? So in this very small way, I said, I want Ed to help her get Ed to take over the full ownership of the homework card for one assignment. And it was harder than you thought. So I said to her, what's your why? So she says to me, she cares about this project because it's a second grade signature project, because you're supposed to be teaching your kids that, you know, you can be as happy opening a homemade gift from a friend as you could from opening a $100 Nerf gun. Mm-hmm. But an anti-materialism message. So I said, that's pretty profound. Is there any other why? And so then she says, well, it turns out that my son Brody, who's super popular, been in school since kindergarten, drew the name of a little girl who just came to school in September. And I noticed when she lines up, she just lines up early and she just stands there waiting for the bell. And it's like so sad because like nobody plays with her. And she's just sort of online, you know, with her backpack waiting. And so she said, how nice would it be if Brody could make her like a welcome to this school, you know, welcome to our awesome, you know, public school in New Jersey. So that was her why. So I said, well, I'm tearing up at your why. So
right.
Say that to Ed. like, don't tell him he has to do this or why he can't, or, you know, make him a list, which he was going to do, right. Make him a list of everything she needs. Just communicate that when emotion is low, cognition is high. So I get them after the holidays and I get them on FaceTime, and Ed starts chiming in and saying, I began Googling Secret Santa projects for little girls with my son, Brody. Because she had communicated her why. And I said, yep, that's the conception part. And then he's like, yeah. And then we wrote down everything we needed together, what we needed to build. We decided on a popsicle stick jewelry box for this little girl. And Brody wanted, you know, colored popsicle sticks, glitter, glue. He wanted a knob. So Ed, the man who's the CEO outside the home, is now telling me his son needed a knob. The little girl, she didn't want to need two hands to take off her lid. She needed just one hand to take off the lid. So that's the planning. That's the planning. Yeah. And then he says that he discovered this really cool store called Michael's. And you get everything you need in one place.
Imagine.
He takes Brody to Michael. They start building the jewelry box. And Julie basically said her life, entire life changed that day. And I said, well, that's a profound statement for something so little. And what she said to me was that it was the first time she ever saw Ed on the floor, first of all, with any of her kids. And she said out of the corner of her eye, what she noticed was that Ed had glitter on his hands. And the profoundness of her seeing the glitter on his hands, besides the fact that glitter is a pain in the ass to get out. But Ed is a man now who has a fair play understanding and has begun to talk to me about what that could look like in a new workplace. Mm. Flexibility for his workers. If I value women's time, that means I have to do a full pay equity analysis to make sure I'm paying women the same for the same job. Looking with me at a fair, encouraging men to model doing more in the home, having men change diapers on Zoom. So I do believe it starts in the home. I think it starts with glitter. And that was the profoundness of hearing from Ed recently.
Yeah. So the glitter is like, for you, proof that he can get his hands not dirty, but glittery, and that he really, you know, was rolled up his sleeves and was all in on the floor. I mean, how sad that you would miss ever getting on the floor with your kids, you know, or being messed up with glitter. You know, I mean, we've all experienced that. And I think that creativity and that connection that he had with Brody over that really empathetic project was just so, so beautiful. So I hope that Ed, as a CEO, does bring it to the workplace and recognizes some of the things that he might have to change about, you know,
it's
about
the only way it can change, right? It has to be. I mean, do you remember was it just a year ago, maybe a little over that, there was the video that went viral about the man who was having the Zoom call, and the little girl came in and he's like swatting her away, then the baby comes cruising in. Like, that was just a really short time ago. And I remember watching that and thinking, why is that such a big deal that the baby showed up? You know, the little girl showed up.
He was so mean to that baby.
I know. So mean. I know. And I was like,
hey, yeah. That recently I saw, I think it was Jimmy Kimmel. I posted it on Fair Play Life, but the contrast between BBC guy and then I think it was last week that Jimmy Kimmel hosted from home late night. And his kids were, or maybe it was Jimmy Fallon, I can't remember who it was, but they were climbing all over his head and on his shoulders, and he was delivering his monologue. And so if that could be the contrast, where we're so afraid of having kids in our box,
right?
But now we're normalizing it, like you said, Beth, maybe that is the silver lining of this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Right. When you talk about nagging, I find this so interesting because you put a little different spin on nagging. And I think I once heard somebody say that nagging is basically saying to someone, you know, you haven't heard me, I'm being ignored. But can you talk about the research of how men described how they feel when they're nagged?
Absolutely. So I asked in my 500 plus interview of men and women, what the top number one thing men, I asked them, what do they hate about home life? And I asked women the same question, what do you hate about home life? And number one answer from men was nagging. Number one answer from women was, I have insomnia because I literally can't get all the 27,000 things out of my head for the next day. So it was the overwhelming mental load for women, what I call the cognitive labor, the conception and planning, not the execution, but all the planning and the conception that requires the thinking about the popsicle stick jewelry box, the planning for what you need for the popsicle stick jewelry box, not necessarily building it on someone else's direction. So for men, the idea of nagging, what I realized was, again, using sort of these organizational management principles, was that when I asked men specific examples of nagging, so I asked one man, like, give me an example. And one man says to me, well, I was locked out of my house over a glue stick. I couldn't come home. He was in White Plains, New York. He forgets a glue stick. He was asked and, you know, I guess texted a million times for the glue stick. He still forgets it or passively aggressively doesn't want to bring it home.
Right.
Because it was nagging. And his wife wouldn't let him in. So as it was stories and stories after that. And from her perspective, she had been working 2 weeks on the Einstein biography and gone to the library 100 times and had the poster board ready. And she just needed the glue stick. But the problem is, from an organizational management perspective, is for men, from a man's perspective, I call this the rat fuck, because it really is just a random assignment of a task. The rat fuck is a random assignment of a task, and nobody, whether it's men or women, like a random assignment of a task, because it's right. All the opposite of what we just said about an effective workplace.
Right.
An effective workplace is context, not control, especially now. That's what everybody's talking about on these Zooms, accountability, trust. Focus on the outcome and not just FaceTime. Mm-hmm. Ideal workplace is context, not control. A rat fuck, a nag, is just actually control and no context. Mm-hmm. Bring me home the glue stick. So in an ideal fair play world, it would have been like, buy the glue stick yourself and redeal for the next project to your mm-hmm. husband, the popsicle stick jewelry box project, or hand him the whole project. Let him do the whole biography project.
Right.
But it's the just asking for these small things. Why isn't the bag back in? Did you take the laundry out of the dryer? It's too many random tasks and none of us like it. And there was even an article that came out about how ineffective it is to pull someone into a meeting at the last minute because people have heart palpitations when they don't have context for why they're sitting there. Mm-hmm. Same concept in the home.
Right.
Why do you think when you have the three steps of the conception, planning, and execution, why did you feel like, or what tells you about why men love to come in at that execution point? Like, what is it because we don't, what do you think happens that they don't take on those first two steps?
It's visible. That's where you get the gold star. You're in the, you're in the market. How awesome for that. I mean, the problem is that, and it's scientific. So this is not just me saying this. There is loads and loads of studies showing that men overreport their contributions in the home. Mm-hmm. The most recent study that literally came out 3 weeks before Fair Play, which was like my dream. It was a Harvard study that showed that women hold all the cognitive labor for their households. You know, what I call the conception and planning. Mm-hmm. So it's scientific. And I believe it happens because I think what's visible is the execution. The showing up in the Little League field, but the invisible tasks, we've been societally conditioned to do that, right? To sort of walk around elfin-like, to make everything sort of perfect. Mm-hmm. And so no one has actually ever seen that. And even for me, I saw it a lot because I had a mother who was spilling out all over the place. But I think a lot of mothers, especially our generation's mothers, were that elfin-like women who were, you know, I'm going to do it all. Mm-hmm. And we didn't necessarily know that there was all these invisible things happening behind the scenes.
Right.
So
and I think
that's where I think it comes from.
And our brain is on overload. So it just strikes me that when we tell someone, you must do this right now, pick up the glue stick or you're in trouble, it's almost like we feel like we'll be validating ourselves or bringing them into the fold and that they've checked a box for us when really we're devaluing the whole Einstein project and the whole planning and the research and everything just because we're assigning the glue stick. And so I think you're so right.
Like just that, when you send me the recording, I need to take that line and just, that insight is to me, it's the core insight of Fair Play.
Yeah, right.
Like you just distilled it in one sentence.
Right. It's so important to not devalue yourself. And so, it reminds me, it leads a little bit to, I don't know if you ever saw that DC and Ryan report on intrinsic motivation and how people are motivated, and they're not motivated from control. They're motivated if they feel successful, if they if they can relate it to somebody, and if they have autonomy. And so if you're telling someone the one job and the one job how to do it, they're not intrinsically motivated to do any of that. But by giving them the whole project and letting them do it the way they want, it just, so I think that this whole thing of the, what is it, the conception, planning, and execution, giving it all to someone is just genius. That was part of the time that I was like, yes, like she totally gets it and everybody has to hear this.
So, and by the way, Carrie, that is exactly right. It comes from all that research, because working with succession, right, in generations of families, I work with sometimes what I call a lot of son ofs and daughters ofs, right? So these are people that don't necessarily have a lot of intrinsic motivation because they're, they've grown up in very, very wealthy families. So I'm very familiar with that research. And a lot of that informed the idea of conception, planning, execution, of this idea of context, not control, because it's what I do with my clients for a decade of how do we get, you know, second son who may not have the best executive function or understand a journey between from start to finish. And now you want to involve him in your foundation or your family business. That's going to be really hard. And so it requires a lot of intrinsic motivation. And so I talked to a lot of patriarchs and matriarchs about that. And that concept is sort of directly the mirror of what I think CPE is for the home.
Yes.
And I think there's the part about even when you think about the autonomy and the importance of that for someone, I always think of it, it's that saying of don't make perfect the enemy of good, right? Like allowing someone to do it and don't fill it with what I think this is supposed to be. You've got to let someone, especially if it's in the heteronormal kind of relationship where the woman thinks she knows what the perfect, you know, Secret Santa present's going to look like. How beautiful,
and by the way,
was
how great
that?
Is that? How great is that, Beth? Because the more we're spending on taking back the perfect Secret Santa project and not allowing our partner to do it, they get the unencumbered mind of being able to focus on themselves, their workplace, their leisure time, because right, men in heterocis gender relationships take twice as much leisure time as women. We do twice as much, we do 2/3 of the domestic load, what it takes to run a home and family. And who gives a shit? Who gives a shit?
Who cares, right?
Right. The last, only time I cried other than the blueberries day was the day that I visited a old white crotchety neuroscientist who's one of the best in the country. And I had access to him because of my clients, because they fund a lot of these amazing researchers, and he was willing to speak to me based on this pervasive messaging I was hearing from women that they are better multitaskers and they have better executive function, right? And you know this from the book, but what I didn't get to say, I say it off record in a different way that I can say it on record because I wanted to use neuroscientists' real names, right? We know that there's no difference, or at least that's what I learned. But the way this one man said it to me was when I asked him, you know, are women wired differently? Are we better at care? Do we have better executive functions? He just looked at me and he said, imagine Eve, we can convince half the population that they're better at wiping asses and doing dishes. How great.
That was such a powerful statement.
And I started sobbing. It was like, every culture expectation that was on me for like 35 years at that time, it was like I was having an allergic reaction to society because I had believed all those things too, that it was on me, that I was a better multitasker. And it's just fundamentally not true. But there's such power in getting women to believe that we're the only ones who can do the homework project because, oh my God, then we'll be wiping asses and doing dishes forever. While the other half of the population will stay on the top of the Forbes list. How great is that?
Right. And that reminded me of my own family, where we think culture and ourselves and the messages that we need to fix everything all the time.
And, you know, one man and woman said it to me in such a good way when I was talking, when they were fair players. And but I love the insight when the man said to me, I'm a plate. similar, Kara, to what you were saying. He said, I'm a plate. And when my plate is full, it's full. And then his wife said, well, I'm a conveyor belt. And the only way you can have a full plate that you sit down and eat and your plate doesn't get overly full and that's it is because I'm the conveyor belt, taking all the damn things off the conveyor belt. So like, I can't be a conveyor belt while you're a plate.
Right.
Yeah. That doesn't work. And I just love that analogy because I think it's exactly what you said. It's like, can you focus on one task at a time? Do we value society men's time so much? One of my favorite things was calling schools. So I started calling schools all over the country and saying, why do you call women first on your call list? Mm-hmm. And getting sort of a lot of like hemming and hawing. But I think the answer was, well, A, they'll be available, of course. Or B, another a version of we don't want to bother the men. Mm-hmm. This idea, right, as I talk about in Fair Play, that we treat men's time as precious. Men's time is diamonds and women's time is infinite. And now that we're living in the space-time continuum collapse, if we keep making that distinction that men's time is guarded and finite and women's time is infinite like sand, we're going to die. Yeah. Women are going to die, not from the disease, but from burnout, from autoimmune diseases, from insomnia. Like, we're not going to be able to keep doing this.
So and it's extraordinary, the comment. Kara and I have had this conversation so many times in just the, I mean, how long has it been now that we've been in stay in place? Was it 4 or 5 weeks? The amount of women who already are at that breaking point. Like, how can you bring children into the home and homeschooling, have your career going, no one's leaving the house. Like, everything is descended upon this household. And the bulk of that descent, that that work has fallen on the mother's shoulders.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
And then we were even talking in this next, what will happen, but the second wave of this incident is going to be when we do start to have the ability to go back out without childcare anymore, because if childcare facilities have fallen away with no place to send her, then kids can't go back to school. Whose career is going to take that hit, right? Who's going to say, well, I'll have to stay home with the kids then?
It's happening all over. I interviewed two twins yesterday, two twin women, adults. But one is, her husband got deployed the day before this happened to the Middle East. Uh-huh. And she's a civil engineer, and she said, I have three kids at home. And so that was the end of my job, the end of my career. And her sister is a nurse, and her husband was deployed to Tampa as an essential worker, also in the military, and that's the end of her career. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, I think it's that dominoes effect. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing a panel next week with Kirsten Gillibrand and some high profile companies to say, please don't let women fall off the ladder now.
Right.
You're going to just have this, like, we have blinders on. It's all colorblind and gender blind. And we're just looking at productivity. Well, what you're going to see workplace is that men are more productive, right? Because we have a terrible, we don't value care. We never have. That lid has gone off. So there has to be other reasons why you think women are important in your workplace. Recognizing the challenges that you've put on us. And I think, like I said, that could be our silver lining. You know, talking to the Eds of the world and realizing that there is value in care and modeling men doing it. I think that agency has to start in the home for us to start seeing systemic change.
And I'm so glad that you're having what an important meeting. And I am worried, and I don't want to be fear-based, but I am worried that all the ground that we've gained or we're starting to gain would be stalwarted by this COVID, because I read an article about the fact that childcare is going to be very hard to come by because many childcare places are going to be closing their doors. They're small businesses. And so the demand is going to be really high and nobody's going to be able to fill places. And so now women are going to continue to have to try to do school and do it all again. And I just don't want to take a step back. I'm very concerned about that. So hopefully, I love how you say, that he's a fair player. Hopefully you can just keep picking up fair players along the way, Eve. And
I look at it as a political campaign, Kara. Like, basically, you know, I have a friend who ran for Congress, and she said to me that you do one voter at a time.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's big, big, you know, audiences, sometimes you're just talking to that person and you're doing shaking hands. Like, you go one fair player at a time, one man at a time. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I look at this. Like, if one man changes his policy for a big company, then maybe others will follow suit. And you don't know sort of where that tipping point is. But I do think that, like you said, we can either go back to the 1950s, a very gendered world, or we can break through and say we need universal daycare immediately.
Yes.
We need your economy immediately. And that economy enables other jobs. And so to me, the care infrastructure, Ai-Jen Poo, Cecile Richards, a lot of super majorities talking about this idea of a care infrastructure. I see it in my mind as a care bridge, like a cartoon where you see all these women sort of holding up the United States. And when you pick them out, it falls. So that's, I'm hoping our new infrastructure is not bridges, but our new infrastructure is really this idea of care and paying for care.
One of the things I think about the, it's like a cultural conversation we have to have. And I'm actually a apparel designer by trade, but I always think of myself as like a social anthropologist and studying, and through my work, it's in studying what's happening. And then I sort of distill that into how I would speak about clothing, and clothing being our cultural armor. This conversation is something that has to just keep happening on a, you know, on a neighborhood to neighborhood basis. It's like playing this game within your community, playing it within your family, playing it with those CEO levels. And then there's the part about, I'm kind of fascinated by the idea. And I also, Cara and I grew up together in the Midwest. My parents they were Reagan Democrats, and in lots of ways they voted very much against their own interest. And I always found that fascinating. And they were Depression era. And I look at women in our current world kind of voting against their own better interests. And I wonder, is it at times like our cultural situation where we can't say things like universal healthcare because it makes everyone really nervous. It sounds like socialism. We can't talk about these universal policies when actually these universal policies allow us to have these lives that we need to have, right?
Absolutely.
And it's understanding, understanding what that language means, not being scared by that language, and seeing how this actually makes my life work. How do you help people to connect to like these things support my life? And
they're not scary. Systems. Mm-hmm. When I say fair play's a system, they're like, I don't like systems. I like love. Well, you're not going to like love when, you know, you're fighting over blueberries and you're wanting to divorce over them. Mm-hmm. Systems, policies. These are actually really beautiful words. Like you were saying, not scary.
Not scary.
Caring for other people is not a bad thing. We somehow, I don't know what's happened to our culture where we think we all have to do it on our own, this individualistic nature. We are as interconnected as how we wash our hands, as we see today, as interconnected as how we connect is who we become. And I think that's what I've learned from a lot of my clients who fund in 0 to 3. The top researchers, that's their conclusion. How we connect is who we become. Mm-hmm. I think at a broader societal level, that's our question that we're going to have to ask after this. Because we're all going to live and die on how connected we are.
Mm-hmm. Right?
It's the only thing that matters in life. You know, everybody, it boils down to your relationships and how connected you are. Nothing else. Like, it doesn't matter if you have the green Ferrari. So it matters what your connections were throughout your life. So I think from that is a life fully lived. And otherwise, it doesn't matter. So, and that's what we're finding.
And COVID-19 shows us that we can't, have we ever more than right in this moment seen how we are impacted by one another, right? Mm-hmm. And we can think that we're separate from countries that are far across the, you know, Atlantic, and we are impacted by the virus that comes across, and we're all in this together. And so until we see this health, you know, universal healthcare, universal childcare, universal everything, it is universal.
Absolutely. So. And I think there's this one story I can end with, but there's this, my colleague who works in this very niche field I do called me and said, there's a story about this funeral and I needed to call you. And I said, well, that's really sad that you feel like, you know, funerals trigger my thinking about me. What he was saying was that he'd gone to the funeral of like a mutual client, so a client that a colleague of a client that I have. So they're all sort of this echelon of very, very wealthy men. And he went to the funeral, and this was recently, and they, his daughters go up, and instead of starting to speak or tell a story, they just start reading these poems. These silly, beautiful, they sounded like Shel Silverstein type poems, but they were all focused on losing teeth and a tooth fairy. And so they each, three daughters went up. And then when you found it afterwards, what these were the poems, this man was a very successful executive, but he was also a poet. Those were the poems he wrote to his daughter every time that he was the tooth fairy.
Oh.
So they said that the audience was bawling. And nobody talked about his career. Actually, nobody went up and said, this man built this billion-dollar business and he was an amazing entrepreneur. That really wasn't the theme. The theme of this entire eulogy, these poems, that these beautiful, like I said, these very beautifully written poems. And I don't think anybody in that audience in his work life knew he was also a poet, which is also sad to me because that's the humanity of who he was. And I wish that, like, in this generation, what if that CEO came into the office and said, I want to read you the poem I read to my daughter? Maybe, what if that was the staff meeting? And not just, like, what the results were for the company. Think about that human connection and empathy and the productivity he'd probably get out of his employees if they knew that side of him. So I think about that man a lot now, especially during COVID. It feels a little like sad and, you know, dark to think all about eulogies, but I am feeling very sentimental right now.
Yeah, I think that's a very profound thing that, that you just said, and it reminds me of why you need a unicorn card, right? You know, because I think whatever your passion is, it just adds to the fabric of your life in such a deep way that's longer lasting than anything. So I really love that story, and thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for your
time. You guys are saying.
Pardon me?
I love how you all both are distilling all these concepts in such a beautiful way.
Well, you made it
easy. That was beautiful. That was really beautiful. And it is an amazing, you offer a huge gift to everybody, Eve. So
thank you. I'm here, you're doing friends. Because yes. I feel very connected to you just even in this hour that I got to know you. Hopefully I'll get to meet you in person. And Beth, you and I can have you really bizarre podcast on being afraid of living in Stuyvesant Town.
And we used to call it Stymie Town. And we have so much to catch up on about Stuyvesant Town. I love it. It was lovely to chat, Eve. Really amazing.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. No, we really appreciate you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Mindfulness at Work. If you felt inspired by our conversation, we hope you'll share our podcast with your friends and colleagues.